for argument is Woods v. Schwartz. Ms. Scott.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Scott. I'm here representing Petitioner Forrest Woods by appointment of the Court. We are here on the appeal from the District Court's denial of Mr. Woods' habeas petition under Section 2254. At the age of 17, Mr. Woods was arrested for the murder of Omar Wilson. And in 2007, he was found guilty of that murder after a one-day trial during which four witnesses, the shooting victim's mother, sister, brother, and the primary investigating officer, were the only witnesses from whom the bench heard testimony. There was absolutely no physical evidence to support any link between Mr. Woods and the crime, and absolutely no witnesses were called by defense counsel at trial on behalf of Mr. Woods. Mr. Woods was sentenced by the court to 40 years on this conviction. After
that's subject to parole? You have parole and...
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I apologize.
No, yeah. Okay.
This court, after many years of state court, both direct appeal and post-conviction litigation, granted a certificate of appealability, and then obviously the petition to the district court. This court granted a certificate of appealability on four issues, which are addressed in the briefs. I'd like to focus my time today on the claim for ineffective assistance of counsel based on trial counsel's failure to investigate and call alibi witnesses. The question, of course, is whether the state court unreasonably applied the Strickland standard when considering this claim, and then, of course, reviewing the district court's opinion on the same. It's important to consider the context, the background for this claim, which comes, I think, from the trial testimony, from the evidence that was presented during this one-day trial. Unfortunately, the district court did not consider the trial transcript. It was not part of the district court record. We did move to supplement the record on appeal to include that trial transcript, so it is before this court.
No, this isn't allegedly, at least procedurally, defaulted, is it?
Correct. This claim, the district court, the state agrees and the district court agreed that this claim has been preserved for review. At the trial court, in the trial court, as I said, the case presented by the state was based entirely on eyewitness testimony, and primarily the testimony of a Miss Kenya Wilson, who is the sister.
But what weight would a family's alibi testimony have?
What weight? Well, you know,
believes that. I mean, you know, of course the family is happy to testify to an alibi, but I don't know why.
I don't think it's fair to assume, Your Honor, that just because someone is a family member that they wouldn't be testifying truthfully or...
No, there is very good reason to believe that they would not testify truthfully.
And if, Your Honor...
Testify truthfully so that the son and brother goes to prison for 40 years? No.
Well, you know, if the unfortunate set of facts for you is that on the night that a murder that you've been accused of occurred, you were at home with your family, if that's what's available to you, if that's the testimony that's available to you, I would say it's incumbent upon trial counsel to present that testimony, especially in light of the fact that the only evidence...
No, I think that's true, but, unless he thinks it would be really badly demolished on cross-examination, but the question is whether it would make a difference.
Well...
Because you have two eyewitnesses, and... If the only thing against that is family alibis, hard to believe that that would carry much against eyewitnesses.
I hear what you're saying, Your Honor, but I think when you consider the fact that the eyewitness testimony is perhaps not as unassailable as either the state court or the district court characterized it, that the testimony from an alibi witness would actually bear some weight, in particular when there are inconsistencies with respect to the eyewitness's description of the assailant, when there are concerns about the way in which the identification process was handled, and all of those things exist here, and they become clear somewhat from the trial record. Trial counsel did not do the best job of developing that record at trial, and when you combine sort of those failings with the failure to call the witnesses that were available to provide this alibi, it's troubling. It's a deficient performance, and moreover, I believe that the prejudice is manifest.
What's the witness going to say? The affidavit says he doesn't know, basically, doesn't it?
The affidavit said he did not recall him leaving.
Well, yeah. What's that going to do?
Well, you know, I'd say that a layperson, a non-lawyer, to that kind of a person writing an affidavit, I don't recall them leaving, it may very well be the same thing as affirmatively he did not leave.
Well, I don't recall is what somebody might put down in order to avoid perjury or something. So they say, I don't recall him leaving. In other words, I guess you would say, well, he might have said he's still there or he didn't leave or something, but that isn't what the affidavit says. And so if you maybe, I don't know, I guess he didn't even interview him. Is that the problem?
Well, you know, Your Honor, I would just suggest that from my perspective, a layperson saying, I don't recall, I think it's hypercritical to read an affidavit from a layperson that way.
But what he actually says is, I don't recall him leaving the house any time that night because we sleep in the same room, which is entirely consistent with saying, you know, I was asleep, so I don't know what happened. Could have left, not left.
Or it's consistent with, you know.
No, it's consistent with your position. It seems very weak.
And the trier of fact here is an experienced judge, not a jury, and
sure,
who may hear stuff like that all the time, and maybe the defense lawyer says, well, if this is the best this guy can say, that I don't recall my brother leaving, we sleep in the same room, how does that weigh in comparison with the attack on the identification and so forth?
Well, I mean, I think it certainly could have been used to bolster the attacks that he did attempt to make on the identification. And on the identification issue, which I think is a very strong point for Mr. Woods, his direct appeal counsel failed to preserve that issue for review in the post-conviction proceedings. It was it was held waived at the state post-conviction level, and then of course held procedurally defaulted by the district court. So there's an abundance of failings that sort of pile one on top of the other with respect to trial counsel's performance. And you know, we get and with respect to direct appeals performance, which get us to the point where the one claim that everyone agrees is not waived is this alibi claim, which again I would argue, and I have argued, supports a finding that there's a reasonable probability that there could have been a different outcome here, that when weighed against the identification testimony, the alibi testimony may very well have supported a different outcome. And I'll emphasize that it's particularly troubling that the district court ruled on this Strickland claim not having reviewed the trial court transcript, sort of provide this context and this background for what trial counsel's performance overall actually was and what the evidence actually was, as opposed to the characterization that's given in documents that are in the record. I think reviewing the transcript, as this court has held, you know, with respect to a Strickland claim, is an important part of making the determination whether the performance was deficient and whether there's prejudice.
But the district judge can take the facts as found by the state court, the last state court reviewing it, unless you show that they were clearly erroneous, or I can't recall the exact.
With respect to the facts as they were determined, but I think you still miss the overall context of what's happening. I think to see trial counsel's overall performance, it's necessary to read the transcript.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Scott. Mr. Levin?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the respondent appellee, Gregory Schwartz. I'll first just quickly address Judge Posner.
True, there's no evidence about motive or weapon or anything. Just the eyewitnesses.
That's true. There was no testimony about motive. Or
didn't the police do an investigation? I don't understand.
There's nothing in the record about that, but there were
no evidence of a previous relationship between the defendant and the victim.
There was no testimony about a previous relationship. I believe one of the eyewitnesses testified that they didn't know the petitioner.
So what about, did he have a prior criminal record?
I don't know the answer to that question.
That would have been come out at the sentencing, wouldn't it have?
That would have. I don't know the answer to that question.
Did I hear it correctly? He was 17 at the time?
He was 17 at the time. I will say, though, that there were two very credible eyewitnesses here. The district court judge, who did hear all of the different weaknesses with that testimony that my opposing counsel points out, the trial judge, as the finder of fact, heard all of that and still found in particular Kenya's testimony to be very credible. Kenya testified that she had a face-to-face encounter with the perpetrator for 3 minutes in a well-lit portion of the home. The discrepancies that petitioner's trial counsel and counsel now point out, the trial court judge made a finding of fact that those discrepancies were actually somewhat overblown. Kenya testified, or the record showed that the description she initially gave to the police was that the perpetrator was between either 5'7" and 5'11" or 5'8" and 5'11". And the petitioner is 5'9".
Was she at the top of the stairs?
She was at the top of the stairs, which would,
hard to judge height.
Exactly. The weight.
But the weight was way off.
Well,
right?
I think that's also misleading. She did, for one thing, it's very hard for people to estimate other people's weights. What she did say, though, is that he was husky. I think a description like that is far more reliable in terms of what she was describing than putting a weight to somebody. I mean, we all know that somebody who is perhaps 5'11" and 165 pounds, that's not husky. So I think it's more reliable to focus on the fact that she described him as husky and he turned out to be husky. I think that's a more reliable indication of the reliability of her description.
I don't know what the record shows on this as far as the testimony, but she's watching for 3 minutes. Is she overhearing a conversation or is she participating in a conversation?
She's asking, why? What are you doing? Why are you holding
my
brother?
Okay, so she's conversing with him then. Okay.
She is speaking. They're not responding to her. Omar, the victim, is yelling for Terrell. Terrell, Terrell.
It's the
brother? I believe there might have been some testimony that Omar told Kenya to go away. I'm not exactly sure about that, but there wasn't really a conversation. I will point out, and additionally,
how did the police fasten on him as the murderer? I don't know.
Well, there was testimony that Detective Gensel got a phone call from a Chicago Housing Authority officer from the area where Forrest Woods lived. There's no testimony about what he said, but the testimony was, I got a phone call from Officer Huggins. I then went over to that station, and I got some pictures, one of which was of Forrest Woods. I then brought those seven pictures to
Well,
Ken.
Why did he have a picture of Woods?
That's not in the record. All we know is that I believe.
I don't understand. Why didn't that CHA officer testify? Someone got the idea that Woods might be the murderer, right? That's why there was a lineup. So, but there must be a history. Why it wasn't picked by random.
Yes, that's true. We can
only. Nobody asked. The judge didn't ask. How did you find this person? If the eyewitnesses didn't know who this person was, didn't know the name or anything, never seen him before, how on earth do you find the photograph to put in the photo lineup?
I think that certainly would have made a stronger case, but I don't think it was necessary here. We did have.
But
two
I
didn't
understand. Isn't anybody curious?
Apparently.
Doesn't the judge wonder? Well, if these people didn't know who the who this person was. How on earth did the police put him into a lineup?
They had a picture of him also, so obviously he'd been there before.
Well, yes, so they had some. But I think the fact that – I think the picture is also important because we know at first Kenya did go to the police station, two different police stations, and she viewed over 2,000 mugshots and did not pick out anybody. So she was very conscientious here about identifying the person that she saw rather than just trying to pick out, you know, the first person or just find somebody. She was very conscientious about this.
Okay, she looks through 2,000. Now, how does it get – what then happens that – is he in the next 2,000 or what? He's looked through 2,000.
She looked through mugshots at two different police stations, and neither police station had a photo of Forestwood, so she obviously couldn't pick anybody out. It's later when Officer Gensel goes to her place of employment and shows her a photo array of 7 photographs.
Okay, so the question is, how did Gensel decide to include Woods' picture in a photo array? How did he pick this guy out of the tens of thousands, right?
I think it's fair to infer from the record that the phone call he got from Officer Huggins included...
Did he testify at the trial?
No, he did not testify to this. Officer Huggins?
No, Gensel.
Gensel testified.
Well, did someone ask him? He testified that he got some tip from the Chicago Housing Authority?
He testified that he got a phone call. It most likely would have been hearsay to say what Huggins told him, but he said, I got a phone call from Huggins, and what did you do next? I went.
It's not hearsay to testify to what someone tells you on the phone. It's hearsay if you try to use that as you know, evidence for the truth of what the person on the phone said. But if you're just asking a person, what made you include Woods in the lineup, he could say, well, I got this call and was suggested by someone at CHA. Now, maybe the judge would say that was unduly prejudicial or something, but you'd think at sentencing or something or in these habeas corpus proceedings, someone would explain that there obviously is other evidence against him because otherwise he wouldn't have been in the lineup.
Well, Your Honor, I think it was not that clear, but I think the testimony, certainly we can infer from it that, you know, he did testify he got a call from Huggins, and then he then went over there to get the picture. So he didn't testify that I got a tip necessarily, but I think the judge certainly could have inferred from that why he was going over there, because he heard something from Huggins. I think, though, if I could simply just go back to the eyewitness identifications.
Leave you alone.
To the extent that the petitioner argues that Kenya's lineup identification might have been tainted by the photo array, well, we have the independent identification from Terrell, who didn't view the photo array and then picked the petitioner out of the lineup. So I think that ameliorates that concern. Terrell was very candid at trial that he only got a glimpse of the perpetrator, but it was, again, a face-to-face glimpse in a well-lit area of the house. And the judge, viewing all this evidence together, found it credible. The state appellate court then took the Strickland standard seriously, weighed the testimony that was presented at trial against a relatively weak affidavit from a family member, inconclusive. I think it's important to remember here that Woods was not arrested until about 11 or 12 days after the murder. So at the time, July 10th was not really a memorable day that you would anticipate that his brother would be able to remember such details about the day that Forrest Woods came home at 9 o'clock. His mother then yelled at him because their White Castle hamburgers had gotten cold, and we watched Martin. All of these things are things that the state appellate court could consider in finding that the affidavit was not particularly strong, and that in
the affidavit was written how long after the murder?
4 years. I believe it was 1999. The murders were 1995.
These affidavits are 4 years later?
Harold Woods' affidavit was 4 years later.
And the mother?
Those two were, I believe, 2002.
How long was that after the murder?
7 years. It's in the respondent's appendix, page 1, is the Harold Woods affidavit.
But the Harold Woods affidavit, the date on it is February 22nd, 1999.
Yes.
And the murder was when?
July 1995.
So this one is 4 years, and the other two are?
The other two, the mother's is 2002. I'm not exactly sure the date.
Okay, but a couple of years.
Yeah, even further in time. And but those are not even before this court. Those were not considered by the state court on the ground that they hadn't.
No, I understand. They're the impeachment material.
Yeah. So I think, and again, here it's important to remember we're under the AEDPA. Even if this court, were it sitting in the position of the state court, might find that there was a reasonable probability of a different result, it's a far other step to say that the state court's decision to the contrary was objectively unreasonable, and that's the standard here. If the court has no further questions about this or about the procedural default issue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Levin. So, Ms. Scott?
I think the court is right to be troubled by the circumstances of this arrest and the background and the facts that and the lack of evidence.
Well, there obviously was more evidence. It just didn't get in. That picture didn't end up, you know, by the laws of chance. Look, I didn't appreciate the significance of the gap between the murder and the affidavits.
Well,
I mean, this is fantastic. Nobody remembers that.
Well, I think it's one. I mean, the affidavit may have been prepared in 1999, but that's not to suggest that Harold Woods' memory of that evening wasn't secured at the time that his brother was arrested. Certainly, that's a significant event and would freeze your memory. He was arrested only 10 days after the murder, and you know I think most people would probably think back. Well, what was happening on that day, and memorialize that in some way, whether it's in their mind or in writing. But there may not have been a need for an affidavit until 1999. So I'm not sure that gap in time is as significant as
the court
might suggest.
Well, this is extreme detail. I mean, really, I don't.
Well, again, Your Honor, I would submit that. I don't necessarily agree that the date that the affidavit was prepared is the date that would represent when Mr. Woods actually remembered the events of that evening. I see my time is up. I just we would ask the court reverse the district court's decision. In the least, we would ask that this be remanded to the district court for consideration of the full trial record, including the trial transcript, which was not before the district court.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Scott, and thank you for taking the appointment and for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client, and thank Mr. Levin as well.